How does one company use technology-powered urban farming to grow a huge diversity of specialty crops for the world's finest restaurants? Two words, vertical farming. But just what is vertical farming? What are the numerous advantages when growing perishable crops for city populations in year-round controlled conditions? Rob Lang, our guest for this next hour, will answer those questions. Come with me on this journey into the future of clean food and why Farm One is a poster child for sustainability. Hi, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. And as always, I thank you for being a part of it. Our show today is about food, more specifically about local, rare, and trust me when I say some of it is really rare, and fresh food, New York City style. We're going to be spending time this next hour with the founder and CEO of a company named Farm One, and the person who founded this is Rob Lang, and we're going to find out what they're doing and why it's so important for the future of food. And as our listeners know, our tagline for this year is 12 Years to Change, which is based on the United Nations Intergovernmental Report on Climate Change issued last October, which basically said, people, we've got 12 years to change quite a bit in our world, or the results will be beyond catastrophic. Droughts, flooding, and other extreme weather are already impacting millions of lives, and hundreds of people die every single day from hunger. From my perspective, even though Farm One offers some of the most amazing and somewhat specialized crops, Rob and his team are on the cutting edge of doing something that is clearly a solution that will help us figure out how to feed more people in ways that are sustainable in every way. And you are going to find out why I think that. So now please join me in welcoming Rob Lang, the founder and CEO of Farm One. Rob, I always wonder this. I say this on many shows. I wonder if people can tell I'm smiling when I'm reading this introduction, because I have a big smile on my face.
Oh, great. Well, it's good to be here, too. I have a big smile on my face, too.
I'm really glad. I'm going on your website, and I'm clicking, and talk about going down the rabbit hole. It's like, kudos to whoever did that design of that website. So anyway, before we go into the deep dive on so many of the amazing things you're doing, give us the overview. How did it get started? You're the founder, maybe even why it started. Were you a foodie? You're in New York City. Tell us about live, fresh, and rare food. What fueled the fire?
Sure, yeah. So as you can probably tell from my accent, I'm not an American. And so,
and it's not a Jersey accent. I knew that too.
No, definitely not. No. My background really was originally in design and building software. And I started my career in the UK and then ended up moving to Japan, actually, where I started my first technology company. And that was completely different. It was a translation technology company. And in 2015, I sort of left Japan and I left that company. I really wanted to do something that was a bit more real. And food was something that, I don't know if you've ever spent time in Japan, but food in Japan and service and everything around it is beautiful and exquisite. And the attention to detail with the ingredients they have there is exceptional. And so I had sort of had the chance to do some culinary classes. I knew that I wasn't really capable of being a chef, but I knew that I was excited by interesting ingredients. And I would go to farmers markets, and this was in Australia or in actually the west coast of the US as well. And I would discover really interesting ingredients that I thought were cool. One of them that I came across is called papalo. And that's actually a Mexican herb, which has a really flat, broad, circular leaf that has a sort of cilantro-like aroma, but it's different. It has some grapefruit scent to that as well. And I came across this thing that a friend sort of told me to try, and I thought, this is awesome. But also, why haven't I seen this before? And, you know, I would go back to the market a couple of weeks later, and it was gone, sort of victim to, you know, the changes of the seasons and that kind of thing. And so this sort of gem of an idea started in my mind, and I thought, hey, is there maybe a technology approach that would allow us to grow these kind of rare ingredients year-round? And, you know, if you know anything about New York City, you'll know it's a perfect sort of place to try this idea, because the restaurant scene here is very competitive.
No kidding.
Yeah, and the climate is extreme. So today, It's something like 22 degrees Fahrenheit outside.
I do not miss that.
So the growing environment for farmers in the winter is completely different to the summer. And so it's a great place to do something like indoor agriculture. So at the beginning of 2016, I decided to move here to set up a small prototype farm where we could test out some of these ideas of growing indoors. And we started with that, and we've gone from there. But you know, the genesis of it was this idea to grow rare ingredients year-round in the heart of a city.
And you had to, even the way you describe food, you know, like I eat food, obviously I eat food, but I eat food and I say things like, this is really good, or this I love, this is so tasty. But to go down into, it's like fine wine. It's the flowery, the savory, the this and the that, and you obviously were a foodie. And you know, when you're talking, I'm having a brain jam because vertical farming in the integrated world in which I live in a sustainable way, vertical farming, tell people what it is and the benefits. I could have made a list of benefits myself, but I want to know what you have to say. So tell us about vertical farming because I don't think everybody's familiar with what it even is.
Sure. Yeah. So you'll hear the words vertical farming sometimes. You'll hear about some related technologies like hydroponics maybe. But, you know, it's good to start with looking at, you know, the whole spectrum of agriculture out there. So, you know, when you buy rice in the store, it's grown in a certain way. When you buy corn, when you buy wheat, when you buy flowers, you know, they're all grown in different ways. So there are many, many different kinds of agriculture. What people are normally calling vertical farming now is a practice of growing normally leafy greens or herbs or flowers, sometimes some fruit, and doing that indoors and using an artificial light source. And we use LED lights. And normally people, when they're doing vertical farming, are using hydroponics. And that means that we're growing plants in a water-based nutrient solution instead of soil. And there are many advantages to using that. And growing in a controlled environment. So traditionally, a controlled environment would be something like a greenhouse where you're obviously trying to keep plants a little bit warmer than they would be if they were outside, but also trying to stop pests coming in and weather and that kind of thing. And greenhouses traditionally have been able to give farmers, you know, increased production, both in the length of time they can grow during the year, but also the maintenance of a good environment for the plants so that they're generally more productive. And vertical farming kind of takes it one step further and says, hey, we can be able to grow something in almost any environment year-round. And so we're in a basement, actually, in Tribeca in Manhattan. So we're, you know, as far away from kind of natural daylight and the seasons as you can get. But we're able to create this controlled environment year-round for the plants. And the great thing about that is that, you know, instead of growing something in a field in Mexico or California or Arizona and then shipping it across the country to New York City, we can grow right there. We can grow, you know, we're literally 20 minutes away from most of our customers. Because of our controlled environment, we don't have to use any pesticides, so we're not spraying things that are going to end up in rivers and streams. And obviously, we can grow year-round, so it doesn't matter what time of year it is, we're getting the same production. And we're delivering locally, so you know there's none of the emissions associated with long-distance transport and none of the packaging as well. So one of the things people forget that is if you have to transport food over long distance, you need a huge amount of packaging and insulation and chiller trucks and all those kind of things. So we can eliminate all those things with vertical farming. So the final piece to it is that if you look at hydroponics as a way of farming, which is included in our system, you're using a lot less water than in a traditional farm. So hydroponics uses water as its sort of medium for the water to bring nutrients to the plants, but it recirculates that water all the time. So instead of spraying or irrigating some land where that water is going to end up flowing away, we keep that in a closed loop. And people estimate it can save between 80 to 95% of water compared to traditional agriculture. So maybe that's a good little primer, but I'm happy to dive into.
No, but it's like you're saying that, and I'm thinking, so no insecticides, pesticides, herbicides, right. No Monsanto, no droughts, you know, so many of these things, water safe. And most people that have been a part of the Mrs. Green's World tribe for years know, I've done shows on it, that 40% of the food that's grown is never eaten. No right. food waste. Is that correct? Like, what could possibly be food waste? You're not wasting 40% of what you grow. So
certainly. Yeah. Right? So the food waste angle is really interesting because there's two things going on. You know, firstly, because we're growing so close to the customer, there's no waste in transport, and waste in transport is significant.
Huge.
The other piece is that because you know we're delivering on the day of harvest, by the time our customers get it, it's literally a couple of hours from being cut, which means that it's going to stay for longer in their storage. They're less likely to throw it out. The other piece that's really nice that's specific to us is that we grow everything to order. So we never plant a seed unless we know there's a customer for that product.
Wow.
Which means that essentially, you know, on a weekly basis, we throw out like a, you know, a small container, I guess, like something that you could, about the size of a can of Coke or something. You know, that's the amount of our waste, wow. really. So it's very, very, very efficient. Which is very different to large-scale field farming that's a long way from the customer, that, you know, things that end up dying en route and all that kind of thing. So food waste is another thing that we can tackle really nicely with this kind of tech.
Huge thing. Are there any threats to the crops?
Well, I mean, you know, there's two things I would say. So firstly, you know, we had to start as a young company trying to figure all this out. And there's no textbook for vertical farming because, you know, it's such a new practice. And so when we're growing new varieties, we have to do trial and error and see what works. So some of it's about knowledge and about how to maintain systems and how to, you know, find the right nutrients for these plants. The other piece is that despite, you know, the fact we can control pests and we use biological pest control, so we'll use beneficial insects to control any pests that do come in. Sometimes we do have pests, you know, and so we have to learn how to eradicate those. And like one example, you know, which I'm sure many gardeners will come across is spider mites. Like we had those last right. year. You know, we have to learn which beneficials will combat those. And so that's a learning process. But essentially, you know, a plant that grows in our system is in much more of a safe place, I guess, with very, very few threats and a lot of support behind it to help it grow.
And on scale, if the only problem you have is spider mites, I mean, that's like that's a really good problem. And I did a show recently on a place here that's a research facility, and we were talking about invasive species, and there's no threat for that either. I mean, when I talk about having a brain jam, I was having a brain jam. It's like, this is just all that's right about the ability to grow clean, fresh food and with minor things like spider mites. So you really are the only, from what my research shows, the only vertical farming company growing hundreds of different specialty crops. And we're going to talk about some of those. And I want you to tell me what they taste like. You're constantly innovating. And when you talked about having a technology background, it makes a lot of sense. And you're going beyond the basic vertical farming approach. What are you doing? What sets you apart?
Yeah, so we're very different to, I think, almost anyone else out there. You'll see companies doing this vertical farming approach, mainly going after the mass market for salad greens. So when you walk into your grocery store and you see all those bags of salad greens lined up, there's lots of companies now competing to start to produce that kind of product through vertical farming. And some of these companies have raised quite a lot of money to do that. There's a company called Aero Farms, which is based in New Jersey, another one called Bowery, which is also in New Jersey, and then one called Plenty, which is based in California. And they've raised collectively hundreds of millions of dollars from venture capitalists to try to grow salad greens through this vertical farming approach. And you can kind of see why supermarkets are very excited about that, because for them, you know, there's not just all the benefits that I've outlined earlier, but also a lot of benefits in terms of food safety and traceability. So, you know, we all know about the problems with romaine lettuce, for instance, you know, a few months back in the U.S. Food safety and traceability is a huge topic for grocery stores. And it's something that vertical farmers can often solve because, you know, these farms are very, very clean. They're very, very easy for us to track product from seed to harvest. So grocery stores love working with that kind of product. So we're very different to that. So we're not about trying to be the biggest farm in the world. We're trying to build the best farms. And our definition of best is growing a very wide range of really, really interesting products. So from the very beginning, you know, we started out with a range of 10 products, which we thought chefs would be excited by. And one example was that papalo plant that I talked about earlier. Another one was a plant called Nepotella, which is a Tuscan herb, which has these beautiful little pink flowers that are minty and really, really fresh. So we picked products like that, really with an eye to getting the best chefs in the city excited about this stuff. If you want to go into the mind of a chef for a second, especially a chef in New York City, you're dealing with, you know, an unpredictable sourcing situation where, you know, some of the product you want is being grown in California. Some of it's being grown by local suppliers, but with a lot of variability between the seasons. And you're trying to produce a consistent dish every night. You know, if you look at the Michelin Guide, what they praise above all is consistency, you know. So for chefs, we knew that if we could grow these kind of rare and interesting products consistently year-round, we would have something pretty compelling. So that's what we decided to do. And literally our first customer was a restaurant with 2 Michelin stars, you know, and since then we've added more and more customers that have been among some of the best restaurants in the city. And, you know, this is quite high-end stuff, but also we have, you know, customers who run small groups of pizza restaurants. We have, you know, more accessible dining options as well. So it's not just super, super fancy stuff, but we knew that if we were going to have, you know, if we wanted to grow a really, really good product, that would be the thing that would be appealing to some of the more visible restaurants in the city.
And, you know, I'm fascinated with technology in general. I'm one of those people that would be considered on the older range of the age spectrum, but I embrace technology. I don't fight it. And I just watched a show this past weekend on technology in China, which is very scary, very, very scary to me. Some of technology I don't embrace, but, you know, when there's, you know, 100,000 people in a crowd, they're having technology that can scan the crowd and tell you that I'm there. I don't like that part. But the technology that you're using is what I call for the greater good. So tell us do a deeper dive into the technology. I mean, is it really traced and tracked? How do you even do that? What does that even mean, traced and track from seed to harvest? What? It's like, what?
Well, I mean, you know, it's one of the funny things is if you come from a technology background, often you try to approach problems, and, you know, maybe they're existing problems, maybe they're new ones. You try to approach these things with an engineer's mindset. And one of the things about farming, you know, traditionally, I guess people still have this picture of farmers sort of tossing seeds into a field and, you know, plowing in a
right
sort of
and hoping for
way.
The best.
Actually, most,
literally.
Yeah, but you'll find that most agriculture now, when it's done, you know, at a professional scale, is actually pretty data driven. You know, for rightly or wrongly, you know, farmers are under a lot of pressure now to produce and get, you know, a great yield out of every square foot of their farm. And so there is actually software for outdoor farmers, and people are using drones now to map their farms and to, you know, view productivity on a sort of square foot basis. And so we're not alone in the indoor farming world in wanting to use technology. I think one of the, you know, things that we've sort of focused on from the very beginning is looking at small spaces inside cities. And our larger farm in Manhattan is only 1,200 square foot, so it's tiny by agricultural standards. But our focus has been on getting the, you know, a certain amount of revenue per square foot out of that farm. And the only way to do that really is to have a really good handle on what you're growing and where.
Right.
And so we've actually built software around that. So we've built software that works from the ground up. And you know, I'll give you a basic example of how it works is that every crop has what we call a growing recipe. And it, you know, sorts out quite simple, which is like what seed should you use and what should you plant it into. And maybe when should you move it to one part of the farm to another? And overall, that recipe will tell you, okay, this is a crop that takes 17 days from seed to harvest, for example. But from that, you can do lots of things. So you can say, okay, I'm going to plant a batch of this product on a certain day. And that's going to go to a certain customer. And I'm going to put that batch into our system at a particular place. And I'm going to track who planted that and, you know, what time it was planted. And then as it moves through the system, that will also get tracked so you can see where it was at a particular time. And so when you talk about traceability, that, you know, then produces this stream of data. So if you ever wanted to go back and say, where did this product come from that was maybe problematic, or do you just want to know, you know, you just want to have that that sort of comfort, then that data is all there. As opposed to, you know, on the other hand, if you had a huge field of spinach, and you're harvesting that spinach, you know, with a mechanical harvester doing, you know, dozens of heads of spinach, you know, per minute, and like, it's really hard to then track back to where in the field that came from or who planted that or, you know, all these other conditions around it. So indoor farming, you know, it's sort of inherently incumbent on us to track that because we need to, you know, look at that from a revenue point of view. But also, it, you know, by producing this software and working in a certain way, it gives us a much, much greater ability to trace, which is really cool. So that's just one piece of the tech, but there's many other elements. But in terms of traceability, that's one way that we do that.
And can you imagine the application for farms? I did interview this year someone on the show who has a large farm, and the use of technology is life altering for them. It's fourth generation, yeah. But how they're using technology. But on your farm, you are planting and caring for thousands of batches at any one time, right? And you're caring for it basically on a desktop and mobile device, right? And I love whoever wrote your website. It's like, yeah, and it says things like manages the boring tasks like printing labels and synchronizing sales. So there's that application, which is, by the way, very efficient. And you can interact using that data with your, you know, your plant scientists, whatever. But tell us about, there's so many unique features to what you're doing, in my opinion. The crop recipe data, how are you using that? It was like fascinating to me. Tell us about how you're using technology for that. It's like people will want to know this. My listeners will want to know this.
Yeah. So, you know, when you buy a seed packet, maybe from Johnny's, or you buy it from your local hardware store, you know, that seed packet has a little bit of information, right? So it might say, oh, plant it in shady soil and do that in May or something like that.
Plant in partial sun. That's what you get to
learn. Right. And that's kind of it, right? And
yes.
So, you know, the amount of information you got to go on is pretty limited. Whereas, you know, if you're trying to run a farm that's going to grow dozens of different varieties or even hundreds like us, you need to have pretty good predictability about how stuff is going to grow. So, you know, we've from the beginning said we're going to measure what conditions produce the best output in this plant. And because we can actually control all these things, we have a chance to develop a good recipe. Whereas when you grow outdoors, you're kind of at the whims of, you know, what your soil is like and, you know, what the sun decides to do and what the weather decides to do. Whereas indoors, in this controlled environment, we can adjust that. So we can adjust the strength of the light, or we can adjust the nutrient mix, or we can adjust what it's grown in, or we can even adjust, you know, how what color the light is, or, you know, how many hours a day it is, that kind of things. And so we have a lot of control there, which means that after we do some experiments and, you know, we assess A versus B or A versus B versus C, we can come up with what we think is an ideal recipe. And that, you know, obviously, as I've said, like that sort of feeds into everything else. So then we know how much space on the farm this particular batch is going to take and for how long. And so we can manage space. And it's sort of, if you imagine these thousands of different batches on the farm, all at different stages, it's sort of like this huge game of Tetris, you know, where you're trying to fit in things into particular spaces. And you know that tomorrow a space is going to be vacant, so you can add something else.
Right.
But it's something that, you know, I could never do in my head, and I could probably never do even with a spreadsheet. It's something that you need some software to kind of handle. And so that's why we built all that. And when you talk about, the boring stuff, one of the funny things is that, you know, because we're doing this brand new thing of growing indoors, there's no software that's really built for that. And so, you know, we have to produce labels to go on our packaging. We have to track all our consumables. We have to purchase things, and we have to do all these things. You know, no one's built software for that. So we've built that ourselves, and now it's, you know, a piece of tech that we can use to help us build new farms and sort of replicate the whole process.
So in my world, perfect segue, in my world, since I started Mrs. Green's World, which is about a decade ago, the technology of just lighting has morphed. Like, it is nothing like it was when I started.
Right.
Like, mostly homes had incandescent light bulbs. So fast forward, we went to CFLs, and then we went to LED. So are you able, using technology, to look at efficiencies and evolve the technology, if that's the right word? And do you work with other experts to figure out, because the technology in that realm changes so fast, are you always watching what's new and how it can impact what you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, I would say 10 years ago, as you referenced, the whole practice of what we're doing right now wasn't possible. You know, LEDs were still really expensive.
Unbelievable.
You know, and so the price on LEDs has sort of halved every 4 years or so, maybe a little bit more rapidly over the past 10. And so it's made possible for us to have a lighting fixture now. If you remember the old, like, 100-watt incandescent bulbs.
Of course I do.
we can have a bar that's about 4 foot long, producing multiple times the light output of a 100-watt incandescent bulb, but it's only producing 30, it's only using 30 watts of power. And that will, you know, one of the ways of telling that it's efficient is it gives off hardly any heat at all. And so the plants can get really, really close to this thing, which means that you can stack your growing layers quite tight, which means that you can, you know, improve output on the farm. So that's kind of where we are now, or where the technology was at maybe a year ago or so. There's kind of two developments, I would say, in lighting that are really interesting. You know, the first is that trend that I mentioned, where the price is going down and the efficiency is going up. And so every year or so, the manufacturers will come out with new models. And essentially, they're getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. And so for the manufacturers, particularly of horticultural products, they're trying to obviously demonstrate that theirs is superior in terms of reliability and things like that. The other piece that's interesting is research on the actual spectrum of light. And so, you know, we normally think, okay, hey, plants are growing under the sun, so basically you want white light for your plants. And for many, many applications, that's essentially true. You want a full spectrum of light. But there's really interesting research going on, and it's quite early days. You know, the ability to test these things out with plants has only been around for a few years. So a lot of the research is pretty nascent. The, you know, one little piece that I could sort of mention as a taster is that, if you think about how plants have evolved, you can divide them in one way into two broad categories. One would be plants that have evolved to grow with direct sunlight. So those that would be on the savanna or, you know, the plains. Like, so most grasses would be like a pretty good example of that. And so they're used to getting a broad spectrum light, so mostly white light. Whereas you may have something that's evolved to grow in the shade of a canopy, you know, either in a rainforest situation or even just under a normal tree. And those plants, often it seems that they expect maybe a higher proportion of green light, because that light has been filtered by the plants above. And so they may grow better under more green light, or they may grow better in some situations under more red light or under more blue. You know, the scientists now doing the research are just discovering these things. And they're discovering that, you know, oh, what happens if you give them slightly more red light towards the end of the day or when they're in the flowering cycle? An extreme, you know, example of that is for people growing cannabis. They often find that when they're doing a flowering cycle on their plant, they might want to reduce the theoretical day length, so the amount of time the lights are on, down to about 12 hours a day. Which sort of mimics later in the season. They may use a lot more red light, for instance. So that's one example for one species. But, you know, if you look at growing many, many species, there are many things you may need to consider. So that research is definitely ongoing. So I think in the next 10 years, we'll have a much better understanding. But growers like myself, you know, we're looking at that research all the time and we're trying to incorporate it when we can into our production.
So it's just, you know, you just sit here and you soak that in about what's happening and things changing so quickly. And in many cases like this, for the better. And believe me, in my world, I look for a lot of good news because sometimes with what's going on with our climate assessment, it's not great. And there's not really a great place to insert this, and we don't have to spend a lot of time on it. But another major green aspect of your operation that I appreciated is how you get these precious herbs and plants and everything to all those restaurants. Do tell how you get them. I know the answer, but I want you to tell us. It's not shipping it.
one of the things I looked at when I was starting the business was, you know, where does it make sense in a city to put a farm? And, you know, if you've got a very large farm, obviously it's kind of not economically feasible to put it right in the middle of the city. So people end up putting them in what we call peri-urban areas, like areas between, you know, the inner city and
suburbs. Close.
Right. Yeah, which is not bad. And I think for those larger farms, you know, it's kind of inevitable that they need to transport their stuff, you know, in traditional ways. What I looked at was, hey, what if we could find a good space that's right in the middle of the city? So in New York, that means Manhattan, probably. And what if we could find somewhere that maybe the rent was a little bit cheaper, so we don't have maybe ground floor retail space, but we do have something that's right there. Because if you can do that, then you're very, very, very close to your customers, which means that maybe you don't need a truck, and maybe you don't need cold storage, and maybe you don't need all this stuff that tends to add up when you're a little bit further away. So that's what we did, and we built the farm right in the middle of the city, and we used bikes and we used the subway mostly to transport our plants. We don't use any trucks whatsoever. We don't use any, you know, external distributors. Most of the time, it's one of our people carrying our product directly to the customer. And that's really cool because we can control the whole aspect of that. Obviously, there's zero emissions. You know, I think the emissions are equivalent to whatever that person's lunch is that day, you know.
Right.
So it's pretty minimal. But also it means we have a direct connection to the customer.
Right.
You know, so that's something that very, very, very few companies can offer. And it means we get direct feedback, and it means they get to know us, and it's quite a special relationship. And the last piece of that that's great is that we can then control the packaging a lot more. And so for the vast majority of our customers, we use reusable packaging. So we use you know, what they call hotel pans in the industry, which is sort of standard size containers, which everybody uses in restaurants. We use the same ones. And so we give them to the customer. They pay a deposit and we get our pans back when we do the next delivery. So there's no waste in that process. And if you think about the amount of packages that restaurants are getting, you know, every week, it's kind of crazy. So this is our small part in reducing that plastic waste.
Yeah, it's significant, though. It's significant. Yeah. Waste is such a big global issue. So let's segue a little bit onto the customers. I'm fascinated with this. And this is a long question, but you can answer it in pieces. But why are the top restaurants, I mean, I looked at the list, in New York City, interested in your products? Is the market demanding them because people are eating healthier? Or as you said, it's a very competitive city. So if I have, and these are some of the things I picked up on their menus, like moringa leaves and toothache plant leaves and iris mist oxalis. Is that something that's trendy and great, but also healthy? Or are chefs really and truly authentically looking for fresher food and fresher, you know, fresher flavors? It's kind of a chicken and the egg question, because obviously you are filling a niche that is, it's, you know, I'd say hot, hip, and happening. But where, what's going on? Like, is it all of those things they want to have? I was looking, I'm like, what is this again? Moringa leaves? Oh, yeah, I wouldn't want to cook any meal without those. So where's the demand?
Yeah, sure. Well, moringa is kind of interesting. It's, you know, I don't know if you've ever come across it. Most of the people who have it in the U.S. certainly are getting it in a powdered form as a supplement that you'll put in your smoothies and that kind of thing. It's generally a tree that can grow in quite a few places, but you'll find the bulk of the production in Africa. So that's just a a side note there. You can check out some moringa. It's very, very nutritious, by the way. But yeah, chefs, you know, they chefs are funny. They're sort of, they're in a very competitive situation, you know, not just in New York City, but working in hospitality is really hard.
It's tough. It is a brutal business.
Long hours. It's really, you know, hot, stressful, and all that kind of thing. But in New York City especially, they really need fresh product. Most of the time, it's coming from a long way away. Most of the time, you know, New York is good as a city at getting stuff into the city, but it's not always the best quality stuff by the time it gets here. And so, you know, when you look at a typical sort of delivery of even something regular like basil to a restaurant, they might often have to throw out about 20% of it because it's, you know, damaged or it's wilted. And, you know, so there's already that food waste issue. But for chefs operating at the top end, you know, every dish for them has to be perfect. And every dish they want to kind of give the customer something exciting. And so, you know, I think that if you look at our palates and our excitement for new food over the last 20, 30 years, there's been a radical increase in the number of different ingredients
totally. Yes.
Become accustomed to. You know, I remember as a kid, I think the UK is probably even a more extreme example, but when I was growing up as a kid, you know, we would maybe get Indian food as a, you know, special, like unorthodox treat, you know, but most of it was pretty much British food. Whereas nowadays, you know, my sister has four kids and they're eating Thai food one day, they're eating Vietnamese, they're eating, you know, something from Greece. And, you know, their palates are way more kind of varied than ours were. And so chefs, you know, at the high end are even more in that level of looking for new ingredients. They're looking for new flavors, you know. So we knew that when we started the company, if we could bring them some of those interesting things, you know, maybe things that they've never tried before, or maybe things that, you know, they've seen but not been able to get off on a regular basis, we could have something that's really interesting. And I think the other thing about New York that's really exciting is that there's a huge amount of immigration to New York City. So a lot of the chefs who are operating on the high level, they're from Venezuela, they're from Denmark, they're from all these other countries. And so they've got this palette of flavors that they're bringing with them and an expectation about produce from their home countries that they've been maybe disappointed that New York has not been able to satisfy. And so if we can grow some of these things, they get really, really excited. And I think that all businesses, you know, it's about listening to your customers and really sort of trying to work with them on creating what they need. And so, you know, I mentioned before we started with a range of just 10 crops, which is actually more than most farms will grow anyway. But now at this stage, we've grown over 600 different things to date. And at any one time on the farm, we're growing about 100 different crops. And so, you know, that has mostly been in response to chefs saying, hey, I used to be able to get this, or hey, what's that? I want to try that.
So do they literally, like when you, I wanted to ask you that too, do they literally go on your website and see some of these herbs and say, oh, I don't know what that one is, and then ask you? Is that how the, how does the word get out?
Yeah, it can be that. It can also be, you know, we invite them to the farm for a tour and we show them what we've got. You know, it can be they've heard of something. You know, it can be they used to be able to get something in their home country. Or sometimes they'll put it another way and they'll say, hey, I've got this dish, you know, which is like a creamy dessert or something like that. What would go well with that? And then, you know, our salesperson can then say, hey, we've got this new variety of mint, or we've got this sour flour or something like that. And so we can recommend things that will go together.
Person know, like the salesperson, who's training them? Are you training them? Do you have someone in-house that's saying, here's what you go out, here's what we have to offer? Because your average salesperson wouldn't know this is the best thing to go with ice cream.
Oh, totally. Yeah, I mean, our team is really small still. So we're under 10 people at Farm One. And so our sales manager, Marissa, she, you know, it took her a while to learn all these products. You know, there's many, many hundreds of products and there's many, many variations and stuff like that. The nice thing is that we've experienced, and this is something that sort of, it's interesting, and I didn't realize it before I started this company. When you walk around the farm and you taste things, things. It's actually really easy to remember that thing. We're built as human beings to remember things that taste good and remember the sight and the smell and the touch and the taste of those things. It's like something that's very instinctual in us. And so, you know, despite this bewildering selection of products, it's actually, you know, relatively fast for people to get on board and become pretty familiar with those things, which is really cool, because then we can help chefs, you know, discover their next menu item.
The next green treat. And when you were talking, yeah. I'm thinking about, just think about lettuce. When I was growing up, here was the lettuce choice, iceberg or red leaf. I don't even think romaine was around. When I was a kid, we ate iceberg lettuce. That was it. And so now, like, you go into the store and you're like, what? This is just used to be lettuce. You are probably, I don't know you, but I'm going to guess, whether you like it or not, you're a serial entrepreneur, and you're not just excited about what you're doing, you're doing other things, because I was loving reading about Taste the Future and your edible bar concept. It is not your average date night or experience, but honey, do you want to go to an edible bar with me tonight? Tell us about it. And what were they eating on your website? I'm looking, I'm like, what is that? Is that really food? And it's fun and it's exciting, and people are looking for things like this, in my opinion. I mean, it was like, what is this? Tasting the future.
Well, we, as you can imagine, if you have a farm in New York City, your friends want to come see that thing.
Yes.
And then your friends of friends want to come see that. And so, you know, from the beginning, we thought we were just growing things for chefs, but then we realized, oh, actually people really want to check out the farm as well.
Yes.
And so we started to offer tours of the farm, and we did that, you know, just kind of as an experiment, but kind of as an extension of what we were already doing for our extended network of friends. And the response to that has been great, you know. So people, you know, most of the time they've never tasted most of the things that we've been growing.
I can tell you that is the truth.
Right. And in New York City, there's, you know, when you think about things to do after work during the week or on the weekend, you know, a lot of it is like, oh, go to a bar or go to a restaurant. And this is like a very different thing, but it's still a food experience. And so the response has really been great. And, you know, we give people an hour-long tour. We give them a glass of Prosecco if they like, and they can go around and taste these things, and they get guided by our tour guide, who's very, very knowledgeable, and kind of gives them all the ins and outs about how the whole thing works, a little bit like I'm doing with you now. And it's a really nice sort of, you know, it's a fun experience. It's also quite, it involves all the senses, you know, which is something that's really unusual. So we get a really good response from that. And then we've kind of extended that to say, if you're doing an event or something like that, we can bring what we call the edible bar to you. So we take a little section of the farm, and we'll normally bring about 36 different plants there, and we'll serve those to you with cocktails or whatever you're doing for a meal. And it's sort of an interactive experience that means you don't have to visit the farm to get a taste of the farm. And the last piece of that we do is also classes. So we'll do classes to give you an introduction to hydroponics and how to grow plants using this technology. And that's been really popular as well. You know, there's just not that many places to learn this stuff. And there's especially not that many places where you can see a fully functioning farm and taste all these things and see all the equipment and that kind of stuff. So the farm's location in the center of Manhattan has also been a huge benefit there, because it's very accessible. And it gives the whole operation this nice transparency to it, where people can see, you know, okay, this is what the working conditions are like. This is how people are growing this produce. This is how clean it is. This is, this is the future of farming. And we like being a symbol of that. It's exciting for us.
And what you offer in the classes is, to me, like the whole green enchilada. I mean, I say that a lot, but it is like you teach them about the whole, you know, all the principles of hydroponics, and you go from that to helping them learn how to plant themselves, have their own little hydroponic operation in their apartments. That's part of the transformation of what you're offering. And you could have it, like, I think if I was there, I'd have like a birthday party and invite 10 people and say, let's go do this instead. It would be fun.
Yeah. People definitely do that. Yeah.
It's very different. So what about kids? You're doing cool things for kids, and I always love that. Food, farming, and fun. Tell us about what you're doing for kids to help them. They're our future.
Yeah. There's a few different ways that we work with kids. And you know, first of all, kids come on the tours and they can experience that. But we've also started to offer classes for kids as well. And the classes are sort of a fun version of what you're getting on the adult class. And so we don't make it too complex. But one of the things that I think kids and their parents are really interested in it is giving kids access to growing plants that taste good. And that sounds really simple, but if you live in a city, you know, the chances are you don't even have a balcony or anything like that. So the chances are, you know, that you haven't taken a leaf off a plant and eaten that leaf. And so at a base level, our class is about sort of teaching kids that and giving them access to these flavors and showing them how powerful flavors can be that aren't necessarily from a packet or a tin. And then, you know, giving kids just a really, really basic understanding of like, oh, okay, you can plant a seed in this thing. And it doesn't necessarily have to be in soil anymore. It can be in this other kind of system. And so it's some basics like that. But I think that, you know, we fit into this whole ecosystem now, which is teaching kids, you know, how to grow and doing that in a sort of city-centric way. And so there's a couple of organizations that do that now. One of them that, you know, I've spoken at their conference, which is called New York Sun Works. They're great at installing hydroponic systems on, you know, the rooftops or inside high schools in and around New York City. And they do a conference every year where the kids show the projects that they've done and what they've learned. And that's kind of amazing because these kids who are sort of 11, 12 years old have done these detailed, you know, highly accomplished projects that are sort of at a level that I do not think I could ever have done when I was that age. So there's a huge amount of that kind of activity going on for children and for teenagers in New York City that's centered around hydroponics and growing indoors. And we love to be a part of that.
And kids are so not connected to their food. That is like such an under-exaggeration. In my city, people think our food comes from Safeway. Kids think that's where food comes from. There's no connection from farm to table for a significant amount of the population. And this changes that. Like, you grow food and exposing them to different tastes. So on a more somewhat, I would call it maybe a little philosophical, do you actually press pause and think that on multiple levels, and I really mean every word of this, I believe that our compromised food supply is literally killing millions of people every day. They're eating day after day after day, and what they're eating is not real food. And every time that I break down once every 3 years and have a Velveeta grilled cheese, I am very conscious of saying this is not real food. What you put in your body was basically food coloring and plastic, but it tasted so good. So Velveeta is not a staple in Mrs. Green's casa, but a constant supply of compromised food is killing people. Do you ever stop and think, because I did when I read your website, you're working with adults and kids in a city, in one of the, you know, most magical cities, but yet densely populated in the world. Do you ever think that maybe you're helping with that and helping kids to eat and people to eat healthier and have the connection? Do you ever give yourself and your team a pat on the back for helping to change the world?
I definitely agree with what you're saying, and we love being part of that movement. I think if there's anything that I've observed over the past 5 years is that more and more people want to be helpful in that regard. And so whether it's companies that are growing food like us or companies that are helping, you know, provide access to fresh food for people, it's a big movement. And I think that, you know, people have become firstly quite aware of the problems in the food system in this country and in other countries. And also just, you know, how working on one small part of it can be beneficial. You know, there's no way that I can solve the problems with the USDA's lobbying and, you know,
no kidding.
Dairy and all this kind of stuff. I can't do that. But what I can do is, you know, I can grow food, and I can grow food in a way that I think is beneficial, and I can grow food in a way that's very visible and give people access to ingredients that I think excite them. And so, you know, we can do stuff that's in a small way helpful to that. And I think the other piece of that mission, you know, I'm someone who maybe 5 years ago dramatically shifted my diet towards whole plant-based foods. And I've, you know, gone more and more in that direction over the past few years. And so I'm someone who definitely, you know, believes that, you know, we should be through our diet, both helping our bodies, but also helping the environment through the impact of what we eat. And I think the best way to do that is to show people how exciting plant food can be and how exciting, you know, these natural fresh ingredients can be. Rather than telling people, oh, you shouldn't eat that, I think we should be saying, hey, you can eat this. This looks amazing, right? And so, you know, Farm One is part of that mission. It's about growing things that are beautiful and taste amazing so that chefs can put those on their dishes and so that people can say, oh, yeah, this is what I want. And instead of something that's processed and instead of something that's, you know, not too good for the planet. And I think that, you know, while currently we're serving, you know, restaurants very much at the high end and it's quite a niche sort of customer base, these trends, you know, they do come to the mainstream. And you know, the diets of Americans are, I think, you know, in many ways getting better because we're, you know, getting exposure to more ingredients and also embracing more of the kind of cultural heritage of all the immigration in this country. You know, New York is a city where there's hundreds of countries represented. The more that the food that everyday people eat reflects all those different cultures, the more varied our diets will be and the better, I think. So yeah, we love being part of that. And I think it's a way to do things without getting too overwhelmed by the problems in our food system.
And I'm glad that you mentioned that, because what I loved about going like the whole loop is, you're right, I'm a big believer in the Great Divide, and it's growing. So the haves are becoming fewer and the have-nots are becoming bigger. But the application of what you're doing is, it is more affordable than conventional farming. People can do it on a small scale. And one of the things that encourages me the most as in my role of interviewing people and being aware of what's going on in terms of trends, school gardens are just the proliferation of those, and community gardens. It gives me hope because it's growing. It's really a thing, as they say in the younger generation. It's really a thing, having your own garden. It's a trend that's so wonderful to see. So what about, you know, going along with the Mrs. Green's World 12 Years to Change mantra? There really are millions of people starving every day, and that number is increasing. Our population as a planet is increasing. I'd like to know what your thoughts are about not just scalability, but applicability, because you do grow specialty crops, but when the going gets tougher and we have to figure out in this country how to feed, you know, ourselves, let alone the world, global, going to 8 or 9 billion people, how scalable and affordable and practical is vertical farming as one solution to address the world hunger issue?
Sure. Yeah. So I think that, you know, it's always important to remember when we're talking about vertical farming is that it's a solution for one segment of the crops that we eat.
Right.
So I don't think it's going to be viable, certainly in the short to medium term, probably not in the long term, for something like rice or wheat, something, you know, for crops where they're not very perishable, they're easy to store, and they require large amounts of land and sunlight. You know, vertical farming doesn't make that much sense. But for crops that are perishable, crops that need, you know, a consistent, normally higher temperature environment, and that are very vulnerable to pests, vertical farming can be great. And so I think that, you know, what we expect and what other companies expect is that the trend in LED pricing, which is the highest cost component of any vertical farm, should continue. So these LEDs become more and more affordable. And they're on a trajectory that's kind of similar to solar, in that solar was pretty much unaffordable for most homes, you know, even 10 years ago or so. And through a combination of, you know, improved technology, cheaper production, but also government subsidy, you know, that has now been available. It's now available if you live in the right place for, you know, pretty affordable price, which is great. And I think that vertical farming tech is going the same way. And so we expect in like 10 years' time for a vertical farm to cost maybe, you know, 4 to 5 times less than it does now, which makes it start to be accessible. You know, it starts to be something where you can say, oh, okay, we could maybe build a small farm to serve a community in a city. And the great thing about that is, you know, they're not making land anymore, especially right. in a city right. like New York, right? So there's only so many places you can put a community garden. There's only so many places you can put a rooftop farm even. But in terms of a vertical farm, you can put it almost in any kind of room, in any kind of basement, etc. There's obviously, you know, things you need to do to ensure health and safety and that kind of thing. But it's infinitely more scalable than any other sort of farming technology out there.
Right, today, the, yeah.
Yeah, so we think long-term, the future should be hundreds of farms in cities, and those farms should be serving communities that they're based in, you know, rather than expecting people to be buying product from a long, long way away as we do now. And the closer people live to these farms, the more, you know, contact they have with fresh food, the more contact they have and more knowledge about that food that they have. And so it's a win-win. And so I don't think vertical farming is going to solve every piece of the food system, but I do think it can serve a really, really key need that people have, especially in cities, for fresh produce.
And the no shipping and the no, you know, the biggest challenge is greenhouse gas. And what you're doing cuts down on greenhouse gas because you're putting people on a bike or having them use the subway to get it. And it's so localized. And as our populations move more and more to cities, it's going to become more and more of a solution. So perfect segue to where is the next farm one? You're learning so much and your technology is so cutting edge. Do you have a desire to have a farm one in Phoenix, Arizona, for example? I'm in Tucson, but you know, just up the road is Phoenix and Los Angeles and San Francisco. What would you like to see when I interview you in 5 years that you can say, oh, Gina, we're here now and here now and here now, or are you just going to stay in Manhattan, which I would not blame you. It's not judgment, but it's what's your vision?
Yeah. So we've been working really hard to make something that we can now replicate, you know, in terms of software and hardware and all these things. We're now ready to do that. We have a plan. We're working with a company to build a farm in Europe somewhere. I can't reveal yet where it will be, but it's planned to happen in the next few months. And that would be really, really exciting because that's a major global city.
Very exciting.
And we're looking for cities.
Europeans are, by and large, a lot healthier in their eating habits, let's be honest.
Potentially, yeah. And then, you know, we want to look at cities around the U.S., cities that have a good restaurant scene, cities where there isn't a lot of local production or maybe there's high variability between seasons. So we're definitely ready to roll out new farm locations. We want to work with people locally in those cities who, you know, have a connection to the restaurant scene or have other kind of expertise that can help us. So definitely, you know, if you talk to me again in 5 years' time, we hope to have dozens of farms around the U.S. and around the world.
And I sure hope you do. I really say that sincerely from the bottom of my very green heart. It's like we need more farm ones.
Thank you.
Okay, so my final words and thoughts are the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization estimates that about 815 million people of the 7.6 billion people in the world, or 1 in 10, are suffering from chronic undernourishment. Almost all of the hungry people live in developing countries, so it hasn't hit us yet, at least not that hard. But what I also know is that 1 in 5 children in the community in which I live go to bed food deprived, which is a nice euphemism for hungry, right here in the good old US of A. Once the harsh realities of climate change hit us even harder before than they have before right here, we're going to be looking for companies like Farm One, people like Rob Lang and vertical farming in general, to put food on our table, fresh, rare, and healthy food. So for today, I'm going to be grateful that I have never known what it's like to be hungry. And along with that, I'm going to recommit to continue my life in a way that contributes to a sustainable and socially just planet for all of us. And I hope you will join me in that commitment. Thank you so much for being a part of our world. Before I say my final thank you to Rob, two more amazing shows coming up. Our local show, our Down to Earth, Mary Atkinson, who's the director of wellness at Tucson Medical Center. Healthcare Now, TMC has an app for that. Another amazing use of technology where literally you can be sick or your child can be sick at home and you can go face-to-face on a doctor on FaceTime and never have to leave the house and get help. And then on February 5th, Annie Sanders, Executive Director of Green Corps. The Green Corps, the Field School for Environmental Organizing. They are doing amazing things on all of our behalf. And Rob, I really hope you enjoyed this as much as I did. It was a delightful show to prepare for. I certainly could not call it work. And I promise you that the next time I set foot in New York City, I have your cell phone. So I'll be knocking at your door.
Great. We look forward to having you. Thanks for having me on, Gina.
It was great. And help us spread the word. So thanks for all you're doing. And I appreciate it and you.
Thanks, Gina.